are listening to Teacher Toolkit, supporting teachers, parents, and students worldwide.
Actually, just earlier today, I saw a teacher tweeting about something, and I reached out to her and I said, I'm doing research on this. Would you like to connect?
We help teachers thrive and survive with classroom ideas, cutting-edge school resources, and research-informed teacher training materials. You will also hear discussions on the policy, guidance, and research-based publications.
2018 marked the centenary of some woman winning the right to vote in the UK. At Teacher Toolkit, we commemorate the anniversary by interviewing 100 women working in the field of education or in the public eye in order to catalogue their lives, celebrate their successes, and find out what challenges they face and discover what they would like to pass on to the next generation. Today, I am interviewing Professor Doris Santoro, an associate professor at Bowdoin College in Maine, Eastern United States.
Hi, Doris. Could you introduce yourself to our listeners and tell us what you do?
Sure. My name is Doris Santoro, and I'm a professor at Bowdoin College in Brunswick, Maine.
And for a bit more context for people listening here in the UK, so Maine is the East Coast, obviously.
Yes, absolutely.
So tell us a little bit more about the college itself.
So Bowdoin College is an elite liberal arts institution in the Northeast. You know, it is someplace that is not preparing young people for technical careers. Instead, the idea is that students get a well-rounded background. They do major in a particular area. So you could major in biochemistry or environmental studies or some, you know, or German or yeah. French. But the idea is that it's really preparing students to think and write and analyze very broadly. Okay. It's a school that has just under 2,000 students.
I was just going to ask how many. Yeah. So it's quite small.
It's quite small, and it's a residential college, and all of the students are undergraduate. So they're all, most of the students are approximately 18 to 22 okay. years old.
And your specific work with these students is particularly in the field of teaching?
It is a little bit broader than that. So I am in the education department, but our education department is not focused solely on preparing teachers. We have students who are studying educational studies, so they're thinking about the history, the philosophy of education, policy studies, and preparing students to go into secondary school. So in the U.S., that is our middle or junior middle school or junior high and high school. So grades six or seven okay. through 12. So I have a dual role of being both a philosopher of education right. and a teacher educator. And in our department of three people, so it's, you know, the entire education department is three people at our small right. college.
Okay.
I both teach courses like Education in the Human Condition, which is all we're reading lots of philosophy. I teach courses on gender, sexuality, and schooling. Wow. But then I also teach courses in curriculum and learning and teaching. And I was just supervising our student teachers in the field this past semester.
So I guess a little bit
of everything.
Yeah, it sounds very wide and varied and probably very complex. And I guess with just three members of staff, that presents quite a significant workload, perhaps, for yourself?
It definitely requires people who can operate both as generalists, but then hone in and distinguish ourselves in our mm-hmm. research. So it is a big ask of who we are able to hire in our department, because we do need to have folks who have a wide range of capabilities, but also then are really recognized as leaders in their fields, you know, in terms of their own areas of research. So it is a big ask. I appreciate you recognizing.
Yeah. Well, I'm very passionate about teacher workload. And I know as an academic world, you know, far away from, you know, whether it's 30 children who are 12 years old or 30 kids who are 21 years old, workload, it manifests itself in different forms, but essentially teaching, as you know, highly complex and challenging. Can I rewind way back to your own education background? Can you tell the listeners a bit more about your own education history?
Certainly. I was educated in public school. Actually, no, that's not true. I went to a Catholic school from kindergarten through third grade. And then in the middle of third grade, I switched to a public elementary school. I grew up in New York State on Lake Ontario. So very close to to Canada. So in a rural place that had quite excellent public schools. And then I went to the University of Rochester, which is a smallish. And so I studied, actually I entered there as an electrical engineering major. Right. And then I quickly realized both that my social life required a different kind of major, and that I really enjoyed my English classes, so I switched to English. But then I also received my secondary school teaching credential there. After graduating there, I worked in management consulting for a very short period of time. Basically, management consulting was my fallback career because I was waiting for my credential to get through the New York City public schools at the time. And so once that went through, I switched over and worked in New York City in Brooklyn. And then I moved, and I was an English teacher there in a public high school. And then I was a high school teacher in San Francisco in the Outer Mission District. And then I returned to New York City and started my my EDD, my doctorate of education at Columbia University Teachers College in philosophy and education. And while I was there, I worked at an alternative to incarceration program for several years, and I also served as a literacy consultant to schools in the Bronx and Jersey City, New Jersey, and Newark, New Jersey.
Crikey. So I mean, that's a book in itself, isn't it?
I guess so. I don't know. Yeah, you might have wanted the abridged version of that, but I gave you the OED version.
Yeah, well, I'll look forward to talking to you a little bit more about that through your social media and stuff. Could you, going back to your teaching career, what did you find the most challenging, you know, in your high school work?
I think I found the most challenging trying to figure out how to meet all students' needs in, you know, with limited resources. And limited resources meaning meaning like limited amounts of my time. Limited sorts of ways, you know, if the problem is really poverty, how can I fix that as a teacher? If the problem is a student is coming hungry to school, how do I fix that as a teacher? If the challenge is, you know, I found it to be, you know, the challenge that I found most exciting is trying to seduce students into a love of learning and wanting and finding a place in school. And I thought that was the most important thing, because there are so many other seductions of that for students to experience much more immediate gratification, you know, in amongst in so many other places. And so I found that an exciting challenge. I was really lucky to work in places where I had quite a bit of
freedom in terms of developing my curriculum. And this is, I know, something that is really unusual for the UK, right? And, but I had a lot of space to develop my curriculum and collaborate with other teachers, and that really kept me going in many ways. People often ask, was I demoralized as a teacher? You know, is that why I wrote this? And yes, I was not demoralized as a teacher. Okay. I was really energized to go teach teachers, and that was something that I was excited to pursue. And so that was the reason that I left the classroom. Okay. But I have to say that the class, you know, that the high school classroom calls me all the time, right? That I'm constantly wondering if I should just give it all up and try to, you know, earn my credential again, and that I've let lapse and
goes away, actually, to be honest. Certainly I've only stepped out a couple of years ago, and I think I have that thought every day. What advice would you give to people that want to start teaching, or those that are considering leaving if they are demoralized? There's a couple of questions there.
Mm-hmm. So for people who are thinking about teaching, find some amazing teachers and shadow them. See what is possible. Mm-hmm. You know, we know that research shows that the sort of placements you're put into with strong mentors matters. So I think that it's not a matter. I know some teacher educators take the strategy of we need to attract more teachers, so let's not tell them about how hard it is. Yeah. Let's attract them. But that's a bit of a bait and switch. And so I really favor an approach of saying, this is an incredibly challenging job, but let's look at some people who do it very, very well, and take some inspiration from them and learning from them. So that's what I'd say for people who are thinking about.
I'm constantly silent nodding, trying not to interrupt. Yeah. Okay. And people that might be demoralized, any piece of advice?
Yes. I think the most immediate piece of advice I'd have is find your allies. And your allies may be in your building, they may be in your district, they may be on Twitter. But find the people who share some deep commitments about why you went into teaching in the first place, and then start working with them to problem solve. That doesn't mean that that's not a fail-safe at all for countering demoralization, but it is, I think, a very important first step. Another place that you might find allies is in higher education, and so folks who are working in higher education, either as researchers or as professors, you know, may be able to be some of your strongest allies, and you could find compelling collaborations together, to improve the state of schools.
Yeah, and I think the last couple of years since I've been traveling all across Europe is education is far beyond your own high school experience for most teachers. You know, there's so many different sectors, and I think so often you can save yourself from leaving teaching just by moving to a different perhaps sector. In Maine, is your jurisdiction, or perhaps all of the states, perhaps, is there one thing that you would like to see change in American education? I know it's huge, but I want to push you to one thing.
In American education, the biggest challenge is inequitable resources, and that the fact that our funding is tied to property taxes, to local property taxes, and is then translates into schools that are in communities having fewer resources, and those in the wealthiest communities having more resources, perpetuates inequities. And so I think we need to take a look first at our funding mechanism. I mean, there's so many things, but if you're asking me one, I think that
that some of the issues around funding need to be addressed.
We just introduced a fair funding formula in England where we want to distribute an X sum of cash per pupil, depending on the demographics of where they live in England. It's very new, but there's winners and losers, but kind of initial summary, I suppose, a bit more of a fairer approach to kind of maybe level the playing field. Is there any particular a favourite part of your new type of teaching work that you learn? You know, often in the classroom, people are time poor, so they're very little time to access research. Is there any certain things that you've learned since your transition into the academic world where you could recommend to other people things to explore?
Okay. It hasn't been new for so long. That's why I'm trying to think of what it is. The freedom to take a step back and look at many different ways that people are conceiving of teaching, or the questions they're asking about teaching, literally having the time and space to see the variety of ways that folks are sort of interpreting what does good teaching look like. I think that's very interesting to me, and something that when I was a teacher, I just didn't have the time to do. Right, I was just in the midst of it, and I had what I was prepared with and things that I would take from other colleagues. But to be able to step back and look at a number of resources, which is why it's so your work that you're doing is so great, Ross, because you've sort of consolidated a lot of that research and made it, you know, put it into digestible bites that teachers can access with their limited amounts of time. I really appreciate the work that Linda Darling-Hammond and the Learning Policy Institute is doing on thinking about teacher retention.
Is that US or Maine specific?
It's specific to the US. Not to Maine. But I think in Maine, one thing that I've really come to that was new for me, so I worked in communities that were largely Black and Latino in the different places I worked in the United, you know, or before I came to Maine. Mm-hmm. But I live in Portland, Maine, and we work in Portland, Maine, in a number of our school placements with the college. And this is a refugee resettlement community. And so one of the things I've really loved being specific to Maine is getting to know the variety of members of the variety of folks coming from various backgrounds who are both refugees and asylees, and thinking about how to best serve these populations in our schools, particularly schools. One of the things that distinguishes Maine is one of the whitest states in the United States. It competes with, I think, Wyoming to be the whitest state. Right. And so the fact that we have so many folks from East African and Central Africa coming to the United States, from the Middle East, you know, these are really interesting demographic changes to Maine. And it's an exciting time to be here.
So that takes us on to then this your book, Principled Resistance. Now, my first question: did you publish these at both roughly the same time? Both books?
I did. I know it was a crazy couple of years.
Right,
but,
are you superhuman?
Yes, but I think that they were different processes because one is a monograph and the other is edited volume. So they were slightly different processes. And for me, I end demoralized saying that we need to, as teacher educators, help teachers develop the vocabulary to say no. And then I see principled resistance as a way to start those conversations about under what conditions is it justified, are teachers justified in saying no? And so for me, they went together very
So can
nicely.
I ask, what was the motivation for, let's start with demoralize. Where did this come from in your own kind of thinking process?
Yeah, so a woman with whom I worked in San Francisco sent me her resignation letter.
Right.
And she sent me her resignation letter. And, you know, I realized in that the reasons she was leaving, none of them were matching what the narrative was about why teachers leave, and especially the narrative around burnout. And because she was not burned, she was successful with students. She was a competent, you know, competent educator who had a lot more to offer. She was certainly aggravated. And one of the things I'd say is that she was demoralized, meaning that she could, what made her work good no longer was accessible to her. And so I first had done a bunch of research on teachers who left teaching. And I called some of, I described that as conscientious objection to teaching, in that not on my back, not on my watch. I'm not going to do these things that harm students or harm the profession. Mm-hmm. But as a teacher educator, I felt uneasy about writing a book. And who wants to read a book, you know, about all teachers leaving, you know? And so what I then did is another research project looking at folks who stayed. Mm-hmm. And what were the challenges to staying in the classroom, and how did they resolve those challenges if they were resolved? And some of them were not always.
So attrition rate in the States match England here, where 40% of teachers leave in the first 5 years in England?
It's over that. It's more than 50% of the teachers leave in the first 5 years. And we're seeing, you know, we are in the midst in the United States of having a teacher shortage. And one of the things, you know, so there's declining enrollments in teacher education programs. And one of the things, while there's certainly issues around where are teachers located and what subjects are they credentialed and able to teach? But the other thing we know is a lot of this teacher shortage is caused by early attrition, early exit. And so we would not have a teacher shortage if we didn't have a teacher attrition problem.
The demoralization, as you've said, comes from teachers' inability to say no to things that they're asked to do because they want to do good for most people. But do you find that that is driven by high-stakes accountability or school leadership or teacher habits?
All of the above.
All of the above, okay. I'm trying to explore which one's the main driver, but I think it's all of the above, yeah.
I think it's all of the above. And, you know, teacher habits isn't a term I would use, but I think that there are things like, I think at least in the United States, you know, there's a fairly significant profile of teachers, the majority of whom are white middle-class women who are people pleasers. Mm-hmm. And so who go a lot, you know, so one of the ways in which teacher habits comes into play is that they do as they are told most of the time until it hurts so much, then what do they do?
Yeah.
They will leave if they're able to, right? And leaving is definitely a luxury that not all people have. Right. Some people stay and are counting the days until retirement because their family's livelihood is dependent upon their income and especially in the United States, the benefits, meaning our health insurance is tied to our employment.
Mm-hmm.
And so not all folks have a chance, you know, the ability to leave. But I think certainly high stakes accountability is a piece of that. And that can come in the form of the effects on curriculum, the effects on students, and the ways that affects the teacher-student relationship. And then also leadership is a huge piece. But then there are also more general pieces around not just school leadership, but it could be district leadership and sort of priorities that are put forth. So I think it's
it's all of those. And I think one of the things, at least that I'm hoping with this book, is for school leaders to start asking the question, what's preventing teachers from doing good work, as they understand good work? And so rather than interpreting, and this kind of now segues into the principled resistance piece, instead of just interpreting teachers who are exhibiting resistance, in whether it's passive resistance or active resistance to policies, programs, mandates, to start getting curious about what's the source of that.
So that goes into the ethical dilemmas. Okay.
Right.
And you mentioned that the motivation for this was a solution to the attrition.
Absolutely. And also, I straddle this world of being both a teacher educator and a philosopher of education. And so I'm interested in the empirical, empirical world, but also very much I'm very committed to shifting concepts where I think that they are restrictive. And so for me, I saw this, if you do a sort of Google Scholar search of teacher resistance, you see all of the discussion of this is how can school leaders overcome teacher resistance? It's a form of teachers not wanting to learn new things.
Right.
It's a function of teachers not wanting to habits. And I wanted to shift the discourse to say sometimes resistance has an ethical source, and it's worth exploring.
I really like there's a short chapter you mentioned, "Do It Together Activism," which is largely directed my own Ed Doc studies and how social media's influence in education policy here in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any quick insights you can offer in terms of how that part of the book evolved and how you see social media contributing to the teacher debate?
Yes. Well, I mean, so what I think is worth knowing is that so many of the folks who I've interviewed or who are contributors to the Principled Resistance book, I met on social media.
Right.
I think social media has this unique way, again, in this idea of finding your allies, it's a unique way of connecting people, school buildings, and connecting them across divisions that, sort of social or professional divisions that where you might not meet. So just earlier today, I saw a teacher tweeting about something and I reached out to her and I said, I'm doing research on this. Would you like to connect?
Mm-hmm.
And so the ways in which social media allows us to cross those professional boundaries, I think, is really powerful, where we can also share research with teachers, and that teachers can share their experience of, like, oh, maybe we thought that this practice or this policy was going to be very helpful, and then we can see the reaction of that amongst teachers. I think another piece of this is that then teachers can find their tribe, right?
Yeah.
And find it with maybe it's a hashtag, maybe it's a community.
Yeah. We have small communities here of teachers in the UK now gathering in bars to discuss teaching, and people are finding their own tribes.
And to have a tweet up, somewhere and say,
absolutely.
Okay, let's find our people. I can't say enough about what I think, I'm someone who was never very excited about social media, and I actually have no other social media account other than Twitter,
right.
Only because I find it so incredibly helpful for my research and to understand, you know, I'm in this tiny corner of the United States in a fairly rural and small state. Yeah. You know, our entire population in the state of Maine is under 1 million
right.
people, you know, and what Twitter does for me is enables me to get a much bigger picture
yeah.
of both what's going on in the U.S., but then also like what's going, I subscribe, you know, to the Times Education Supplement. Yeah. Like I can see, like there's so many things that I can know that are, that's happening in the UK or Australia. So in Ireland and
now you're on the podcast with me in London. So
absolutely.
Okay, one more. So thanks. I'm looking forward to reading the books and I'm going to blog about them. But you're going to have to let me finish my book first. So I think I'll try and get something out after September. One of the focus of our podcast is one on teacher workload, but the other one is this kind of look at women working in education. And in the UK, last year we celebrated the 100th year of the Centre and Women winning the right to vote here in the UK. So if I could just pick your thoughts briefly, how is women ed leadership viewed over in the States? Where's the current dialogue sit?
One way I want to answer that question is to think about the, you know, I think the United States is much farther behind. You know, you've had women in power for, you know, longer than, you know, we have yet to have a woman president. And I think that, what that translates into is women having much less sort of moral authority when it comes to raising concerns about what they're seeing in the classroom. Okay. And so that's a theme I take up throughout Demoralized, is that, you know, when teachers, and I think actually the person in the DIY activism also takes it up, is, you know, when women teachers raise concerns, they're often characterized as personal and coming from a place of emotion, and which is then disregarded as a failure to provide sufficient evidence.
Yeah.
I think that this is happening. This also happens for teachers of color in a way. But for women teachers, I think they really struggle to be heard when they raise questions that are about their work and are a reflection of the when they raise a question that's about an analysis of their practice, but it often then gets recast as merely a personal.
So if we fast forward 5, 10, 50 years, perhaps, what piece of advice, or two questions. One, where would you like to see the women in education in the States in the future? And what piece of advice would you give to girls or young female teachers?
You know, so it's a weird question to ask in a woman dominated profession, right? You
yes.
know, so I think that what I would want.
But I suspect I want to just interject there. I suspect in England that it's predominantly male led. And very,
yes.
And even though 90% of our British population is BME, I suspect it's very similar in the US. But you don't put me right.
Yes, yes, no, it's correct that there's I don't know the exact numbers, but it's, you know, something like 80 something percent of teachers are women, and then a smaller percentage. You know, it is not representative of who rises to the ranks
yeah.
in leadership. You know, it's interesting. Most of the teachers with whom I speak don't want to become principals because it's a job that does not look attractive to them. what I would really like to see are women fighting for and helping to create a hybrid teacher leader roles, where you can remain in the classroom and take a leadership role in the schools. Mm-hmm. I think that being able to distribute that leadership enables and remain in the classroom keeps the best teachers in the classroom while also giving them the challenges that they need to advance in their careers. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to see more teacher leadership in those hybrid roles. I also think it improves the kind of leadership that we see, at least in the U.S. I'd like the role of the principal in the United States to become a job that someone would want to do. Mm-hmm. And so that's good. And that,
were you never tempted?
I sometimes get, tempted these days, but not when I was a teacher for sure. and, you know, I think that, that the challenge is that, it's rarely a role that involves being because it is such a intensified job. It's rarely a role where you can think about being the instructional leader of the school or the leader who shapes the culture of a school. I think it's so diffuse in being that. At least in the U.S., you know, someone who has to handle the school budget and transportation issues, and that it is much more a business manager role rather than someone who is a visionary for what a school should be. So maybe I'd like women. You know, we have a crisis in a shortage in quality school leaders as well. Yeah. And so I'd love maybe women to rethink what could this role be and how could we make it both more manageable, humane,
I guess the also challenge is the usual challenge with having a family and, you know, working in the business of education. Sometimes it's not conducive if you want to be a parent.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we've doubled our podcast time. That's a new record. It's been I could chat for hours, but I'm going to push you to give me some quick fire answers to some questions now, just to finish off. So tell me what project you're working on right now.
I'm working on a project regarding demoralization in teachers of color.
Okay, and any particular books related to teaching that you're reading?
Right now I am, I have a huge stack. I will say that I'm reading Eve Ewing's Ghosts in the Schoolyard.
Okay. And any fiction titles on your bedside table?
Yes, I'm reading Moonbath by Yannick, and I'm forgetting her last name. She's a Haitian author.
Okay, and you mentioned before we came on air, you're off to the gym. So how long is your regular gym workout?
Circuit training for 1 hour.
All right, good. Dream jobs. If you weren't in the academic world, what would you rather do?
A chef.
Okay. What biggest achievement? Something you're very proud of?
At the Denver, Colorado teachers' strike, a teacher used some of my work and said he was not burned out. He's demoralized.
All right, fantastic. Who would you recommend I interview next and why?
Oh, you should interview Eve Ewing, whose book I'm reading, Ghosts in the Schoolyard. She's amazing. She's a PhD from Harvard, who's also a poet who is from Chicago, who was taught in Chicago. And
okay, you'll have to send me her details and I'll see if I can connect. Okay, last question then. Where can listeners find out about you online and your books, blogs, Twitter?
Sure. So I'm on Twitter at Doris A. Santoro, and I have a website. You can Google me, and my books can be found preferably at your local independent bookstore. But if you're in the UK, you probably need to buy it on Amazon.
I've got all the links here, so I'll get them all in the blog for you. Doris, it's been lovely to connect with you and chat with you for the first time, and I look forward to having a conversation with you again. Maybe I can fly over and see how it travels. But thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And have a good workout.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. And I'm going to get there on time, too. It's exciting.
Yeah, all right, good. Okay, I'll keep in touch. Bye for now.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye, thanks. Doris.
You are listening to Teacher Toolkit. You can find out more about 100 Years, 100 Women on our website, teachertoolkit.co.uk, or follow us on social media using the hashtag TTKit100Women.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To continue the conversation, head over to www.teachertoolkit.co.uk and our social media channels to access all the links and resources mentioned on today's show. Why not share this with your colleagues and give them the gift of time, reduced workload, and increased impact? Until the next time, before you look after your students, look after yourself.